Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their enriching stories about lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're exploring our non-fiction library of fascinating topics. So please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is Goldster Inside Story, where today we are going to meet a fabulous, brave, and pioneering guest who broke through those glass ceilings of gender and being a woman in a man's world, who made a difference, who represented Britain on the international stage and knows the ins and outs on the art of diplomacy. What is diplomacy? I've never really known, but we will find out. My guest joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, if it was called that then, in 1957, where there were a handful of women through the swinging 60s, the Berlin Wall, the Vietnam War, and of course the Cold War, and she rose through its ranks, Brussels, Bangkok, Paris, Jakarta. Her life reads like a travel brochure. And among her many escapades, she found herself besieged in a chateau with the Queen. Let's find out about that. And she hobnobbed with communist Chinese generals in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. Now, she's told this most compelling of all stories in her book, Playing Britannia, How I Became Her Excellency. And when she retired, she went on to become mistress of Girton College, Cambridge, and that was the first college there to offer degree-level education to women. A true pioneer who has changed many people's worlds for the good. Welcome, Juliet Campbell, to Goldster Inside Story.
Well, that was quite some introduction. Thank you very much.
Was it true, Juliet, or was I lying for the show, like diplomats do for their country?
It was broadly true, but rather sort of hyped, if I might put it that way.
Good.
Anyway,
I like to be broadly true.
Very much appreciated.
And now, I wanted to ground us, as I do with our shows, and your book is called How I Became an Excellency or Her Excellency. What exactly is an excellency?
Well, an excellency is an ambassador.
Oh.
And I must admit, I struggled with the subtitle. I knew immediately what I was going to call my Playing Britannia. But how did I sort of explain roughly what it was, i.e. a diplomatic memoir? And I just loathed those words like she diplomat, woman diplomat, female diplomat. But yeah. Then I suddenly had this brilliant realization that excellency has to be his or her. So I thought I could, by using that phrase, it would say the path to be an ambassador for a woman.
And now I've left my copy of the book in my other place, but do you have one that you can show us?
I should be delighted to show it to you, because I think that...
Is that you on the steps?
That's me on the steps of the Foreign Office.
I know it's very...
As it appeared in the Evening News sometime in the 60s.
How old were you then? I know it's very rude.
Oh, gosh, I must have been in my early 30s, I guess.
Early 30s.
And the reason the press was interested is because I was the first woman to be a regular Foreign Office spokesman.
Oh.
And the press always, as you are now, I'm sure, the press always take an interest in their own, as it were.
And so you were the media office, were you?
I was in the news department. Indeed, I was. One of my best jobs, I thought.
And so you know the dark arts of both diplomacy and the media.
And I suspect they've changed a lot since my day, but that will be interesting.
Yes, and when you wrote it, I know you're long out of the Foreign Office now, is it full of secrets? And did you have to, did anybody check it, or did you just write and send it out?
Well, you know, I left the Foreign Office 30 years ago, and I really thought nobody would be remotely interested in what I'd done. I wished I'd been nobody in official places. But I was wrong. And I received the chart back on the wrist, and I was told that I was obliged to submit it to the Cabinet Office. And I was a bit nervous because it was a bit late in the day, and I'd got a publication date. They were very good and very quick. And the only things they wanted me to change concerned the Queen, actually. I didn't realise that absolutely every conversation with the Queen, and now presumably the king, regarded as confidential. And even though my two conversations, the first one was extremely banal, it was sort of, I do hope you've had a wonderful trip, Your Majesty, et cetera, et cetera. I had to remove it. So that was not allowed. Otherwise, whatever secrets I let drop were allowed to go through.
Oh, my goodness. So the Queen, however banal your conversation is with, is it just the Queen or the King, or is it any member of working member of the royal family?
As far as I know, it's just the reigning monarch.
Okay, how interesting. And tell me, I mean, you rose to the highest levels of British...
Well, not quite. Embassy, but not the biggest.
Not the biggest, no, but you do a pretty high level. I mean, but what exactly is a diplomat? I mean, we hear this word diplomacy, we hear a diplomat, but what, just sum that up for us.
Well, I think let's start with what's an ambassador.
Right.
Because, I mean, originally, going back in through the centuries, what happened was one monarch sent an ambassador to another monarch. And essentially, that's still what happens. Perhaps when we get to Luxembourg, we'll talk a bit about it. But the first thing an ambassador has to do is to present what are called credentials from one to the other. So formally, an ambassador is the Queen's, or in this case, the King's representative in another country. Of course, what that really means is the representative of government. And one may find oneself, depending on the sort of embassy one is in, and where the embassy is, doing very, very different job. The interests of the government will be very different. I think that's probably the other thing I should say is that really it's a two-way flow, because you're responsible for putting over the government's line, asking what the interests of that, arguing the case or whatever it is. But it's also reporting is quite an important part of it. So one needs to report to London on the state of local opinion on this, that, and the other. And right. Of course, one generally goes around trying to spread goodwill.
As I was going to say, the lavish parties are held in great ambassadorial residences and on the lawns and that sort of thing, aren't there? We have the Queen's birthday, don't we?
I must assure you it's much less lavish names, because the Foreign Office really has been counting its pennies. I think the fact there's been such a squeeze on our overseas representation bunches is really most unfortunate, particularly in a day when we depend more and more on soft power, really.
Yes, yes.
Entertaining is certainly a tool. And particularly, think, you arrive in a new place. You've got to make your contacts quickly. How do you do that? You do it both by calling on strategic people and trying to get to know them, but frankly, entertaining. Particularly, I found asking people out to lunch or something so that you could have one-on-one talk. That really is a quick way to do it.
And when you train to be a diplomat, in fact, we're going to go back before that, but I'm going to jump the gun a bit. When you train, do they actually have classes in how to conduct yourselves for a black tie ball or for something like that?
Well, I had absolutely no training at all, I may say. I did later, as we'll come on to, head the training department. And one of the things I tried to do was to rewrite what we did with young diplomats when they arrived. But it was a couple of weeks course, basically designed to get them to know how the Foreign Office worked and how Whitehall worked and what their place in it was. And no, I don't remember ever telling anyone what they should wear or what they should do. But, and here is something I was issued with, the most wonderful book. It was labeled It was a sort of leaflet, and it was labeled confidential. And it was the do's and don'ts of what to do in the Foreign Office. And back then, in the early 60s, they were absolutely fascinating. Sit in a car, and you were ordered to let the ambassador sit on your right, for instance. Arrive at a party, and even if you had seen your ambassador 10 minutes before, you had to rush up and greet him, because otherwise our guests might think you were not paying him proper respect. That's all that sort of stuff.
Yes, that is interesting. For your own ambassador, not
your
for
own sports. Ambassador.
Okay. So that's what I mean. We've had a number of on Inside Story. We've had a number of ex-CIA people on. ex-MI6 ones aren't allowed to do it because we just discussed that. But they say that the most, and I know it's a slightly different field, but they say the most important thing is when you meet somebody is to get the second meeting. In other words, keep up the contact. Would you say that was the something in your rule book?
I hadn't thought of that, but I think once you've established your contact, you draw in it when you need to. The way I look at it. But certainly, it's important not only to have contacts, but people you know a bit better than that. And there one really finds out fairly naturally who is congenial and who you can get on with. But it's very important to try and have friends in it, local friends, for the country you're in, as well as just your formal contacts.
Yes, it's a diplomatic community, of course, isn't it? And we talked about community earlier this week on this show, but of how one, how a community meshes and glues itself together. But I want to now stop my tangential questions and go back to the beginning. You grew up in the Middle East, just sort of during the war and wartime stuff. Tell us about that.
Quite a lot, actually, because when the war broke out, my father was serving in Palestine, the old days of the British Mandate. And the first things I remember, basically, Palestine. I wasn't born there, but I don't remember anything before Palestine. And he served a year in Paris, and we lived a year in Paris too. But fast forward a little bit until Rommel was coming across the Western Desert.
Yes.
And the British government began getting really quite nervous because it was responsible for a lot of women and children in the Middle East. And my mother was offered the choice of India, South Africa, or back to Britain. We're talking early 1941. She chose South Africa.
Oh.
And so we were evacuated as lots of other women and children through Suez. And there was rather a scary moment on the train when there was unidentified aircraft and nobody knew quite what it was. And at Suez, the ship before ours had been sunk, actually, with this girl on who I knew. But we, anyway, had a perfectly good voyage and ended up in Durban for a while, and then Cape Town. And then my father was still serving. My father was regular army, and he served in the Middle East, in the Western Desert, later in Iran, that sort of thing. But anyway, when the war in the Middle East was more or less over, he was sent back to London. And my mother decided, well, it was time to get out of South Africa. So we had another troop ship taking us back to England. And that was quite scary because that was March 44.
Oh, my goodness.
At the time when the Battle of the Atlantic was still raging.
Okay.
And our liner, because it was the Empress of Scotland, which had been commandeered as a troop ship, sort of zigzagged all across the Atlantic, that actually ended up in Liverpool.
Did you have any protection, or was it just the liner and hoping that the Nazis wouldn't find you?
Well, we had life jackets, life drills and things like that. But actually, no, because it was a fairly fast ship, they decided it was better if it was on its own. And that's why we were zigzagging around.
Goodness.
So there were a lot of convoys, but we were not part of a convoy.
Yes, yes. But it must have been quite scary. As you said, you know, that was the key time. And D-Day was months away, wasn't it, at that stage? So everybody was sort of very much still on a war footing. And you get back to to Britain. You're basically a sort of peripatetic child or teenager then, I guess. Then what happened?
Well, unfortunately, my parents sold the house in England when when they were in Palestine. So we spent a while, my mother and my, particularly me, because my brothers went to Orleans, staying with friends and relatives. I went to lots and lots of different things. And to make things worse, my mother fell ill at that stage. She had a lot of rather bad health in her life. And so I had a stage with a perfectly decent sort of governess who I was absolutely unbeastly to. I think I really resented her very much indeed. But anyway, I eventually ended up at Warwick's Beehive. Lovely thing. Motto, better be than seem, better do than dream. Yeah. It was a little boarding school down in Sussex.
At what stage did you want to become a diplomat and join the Foreign Office? And was there anything else that you wanted to do? Did you want to become a champion Olympic show jumper or an airline pilot or something like that?
Well, I think the sort of a catalyst really was my parents moving out to Beirut, because my father retired from the army after the war, but very quickly got a job with UNRWA, the Palestine Refugee Organization, which was up in the news at the moment. And so the family base moved to Beirut. And my parents did something rather remarkable, actually. They took me out of my boarding school for a term at a time. And so I spent two different terms, such as French school in Beirut as well.
Yes.
But I increasingly found that Britain was really grey and miserable, and Beirut was such fun. And as I went on in my teens, I think I also became increasingly aware that a lot of rather glamorous young men were learning Arabic for the Foreign Office in the hills at MECAS, the Middle East Center for Arabic Studies, was a place called Romana. Just don't know if you know them. I used to see quite a lot of them. I increasingly thought, well, you know, if they can do it, what about me? That sounds a pretty good life.
And did anybody in particular urge you to do it? You know, any contacts, any networks sort of got you a step in the door?
No, I don't think it occurred to many people that this was a career for women back then. Because what had happened was that after the war, I think it was 1948, there was a Butler which opened up the Foreign Office to women. But there were still quite strict conditions. There was a quota. I didn't actually know that. And there was no risk at all of its being broken. But the really important thing was that women who got married had to leave. And so, not surprisingly, quite a number of those who joined did leave. In fact, only Bevin is reported to have said that they turned the Foreign Office into a marriage bureau.
So can I just clarify, is that if you were a woman and you joined the Foreign Office, when you got married, you have to leave, not if you got pregnant or became a mother, you had to leave?
When you got married, I think you would certainly have had to leave if you got pregnant.
So you did not get married?
I don't recall that happening.
Did you get married?
Well, I did, but much later on, actually. I didn't marry till I was in my 40s.
Okay.
And by then, the rules had changed.
How interesting.
I'm glad to say the Foreign Office changed them before the Equal Opportunities Act, but only by a couple of years.
So you applied to join without contacts necessarily or anything like that, and you were given an interview and you got the job.
Well, it was a long process, but actually, because I was writing letters to my parents. I should perhaps put that in now, because that's how a lot of this detail is so precise. But I wrote a very detailed account to my parents of how one took the exams for the civil service or foreign service back then. And I find that still pretty interesting, actually. So I gradually started with written exams. And then there was something that was known, though it was in London, in Savile Row, it was known as the Company House exercise, which was about 2 or 3 days being interviewed in small groups. And then there was a final selection board.
And how many women joined the day you joined, or joined in that group, or was it all men?
Well, actually, nobody did, including me. Because I fluffed one of the interviews. And they were obviously quite interested in me, but decided that they weren't going to take a very firm punt on me. And I'd sort of more or less given up when I got this message saying, but if I'd actually liked to go and work in the Foreign Office on a temporary basis and take the exam again, do so. And that's what I did. But I think one reason they were quite keen to make this offer was that they'd had no women at all the previous year. I think there was one the year before that, and there were no women getting through in my year either. I think women were discouraged from taking the exam, basically.
Well, it sounds that if you get married, you get fired. I think that would be particularly if you're in your 20s or something like that. And the day that you walked up that, probably not that day, but you walked up the steps of the Foreign Office, your first day at work, what was going through your mind?
Well, it's quite funny because my parents were back in England by then, and my father drove me to the Foreign Office. And you know, we drove straight up Downing Street and through into the Foreign Office courtyard, and he dropped me there. You see, because of security now, it's very, very different.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, I got up and I apparently told him, because he told me later, I said, I've never felt more out of place in all my life. But anyway, I walked up the steps.
And let's just clarify, you were not being hired as a secretary. You were hired as a diplomat.
I'm sorry, I've been talking, when I talk about entrance exams, I'm talking about its entry to what was known as the fast stream, diplomatic stream of the Foreign Office.
Yes, yes.
Because, of course, there were secretaries there.
Yes.
Each department had a sort of group of secretaries who were known as the departmental ladies.
And talk us through that first week. I'm sort of, because we see these old movies of going into these wood offices with lots of women on these big typewriters and that sort of thing. What did you do in your first week?
Well, I reported to a very nice man called Martin Anderson, who presented me with a whole pile of files, each tied up with red tape, and told me to go away and read them and come back later. And when I did, he sort of went through them and he explained to me what I was expected to do to each one. And there were thousands of different bits of paper. If it was a draft telegram to a post, it was one paper. If it was a minute to somebody, a minute to sort of comment on something, it was another. If it was going to go up the ministers, it was a different. It was, you know, all that was terrifically complicated, and one spent a lot of time trying to understand all that. I was quite lucky. I was very lucky, actually, because my first job was the Western part. And in the Foreign Office, this is on the Downing Street side. So quite a lot of my time, I had a window looking over number 10 to watch Lady Macmillan having her Christmas parties.
I was
going like to
say, was looking overlooking number 10's garden or the number 10 door?
Facade.
Absolutely. And how long before they sent you out to a foreign posting, and what was it?
Well, what eventually happened was that I was given an offer to go to Brussels for the first negotiations for Britain to try to get into the common market. That's the ETH negotiations.
Oh, yes.
And I was only sent at the very, very last minute moment because it was decided that there would be a sort of joint secretariat negotiation, provided largely by the secretariat and the ETH. EEC Council of Ministers. It still was EEC back then. But there would be a couple of Brits attached to it. And one of them was me. It was absolutely fascinating when we get onto that.
No.
Because I sat next to the chairman through most of those negotiations.
And was this the negotiations where it was that Charles de Gaulle kept saying, no, 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 they cannot join?
Well, he didn't say no till the very end.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever looked. You can still find online the most wonderful footage of some of de Gaulle's press conference. And everybody's treating him with such deference and respect. No really nasty questions from the journalists. He was a master of the ambiguous.
Yeah.
So he kept on sort of explaining that there were difficulties, but he never really got round to saying no to the very end.
We have a note here from Marguerite. Thank you for this, Marguerite. Humphrey, you have the most interesting guest. Juliet is marvelous. And we're only less than halfway through the show. Thank you. Anybody got any comments, questions, anything to ask Juliet? She will answer them because she's no longer a diplomat and she can say whatever she likes. So anything you want in the Middle East, Europe, Asia, you've worked everywhere. You mention in a bit here about the imposter syndrome. This is and you did sort of talk about it a bit, the confidence problems. So when you went to Brussels in this quite senior role, even though you were young then, explain your inner feelings of confidence and imposter.
It didn't really apply so much there because it was a pretty junior role, my being part of the area. I mean, I think it's a problem many women, and of course some men have too. As you advance and you find yourself speaking for, I don't know, well, representing the British Embassy on a committee or something, one suddenly thinks, goodness, who might have been doing all this? And I mean, I think I dealt with it in two ways. One is to try and make sure I really knew what I was talking about, that do one's homework well. But the other one really is to think of oneself as the role rather than oneself.
Sure.
So if I was at that meeting, I was the British Embassy. It wasn't just Juliet Campbell feeling a bit cowardly. Right. Yeah. I mean, occasionally that cracked and one would find one had a... I had to give evidence once to a committee in the House of Commons on some EEC stuff. And I was with a lawyer, and the lawyer had all the first questions. And then they got round to asking me, and my voice kept just sort of cracked. And I think, you know, sometimes the nerves get the better for him. But on the whole, I think I managed that quite well.
And do you think that the imposter syndrome, for want of a different phrase, is affects women more than men?
I think it probably does, or perhaps I should say did, because there was still that feeling that women were slightly out of place and unusual.
Yes.
I mean, there was slightly a feeling that women needed to do that much better to prove themselves.
Yes. I think with the colleagues, the male colleagues of mine, is that in very senior positions, they get it in a way that they wonder when they're going to be rumbled and found out that actually they're not quite good enough for the role that they're in.
Well, that's it.
Yes, that is it, is it? That's what much of it. Yes.
Yeah, it's sometimes just, goodness, what am I doing here? And then sometimes, well, surely it's only me. I can't really be that.
Yes.
But while we're on that subject, a very interesting piece of research I came across while I was in the training department, actually, which looked at the personal reporting, performance report on women versus men. And they discovered, and I'm now talking back in the early 80s, so I would like to think it's no longer the case, that for any given level of performance, as it was seen, women were probably one level down in potential on men.
Right. Okay.
I found that really fascinating because I think it's, I'm sure, totally unconscious bias.
Yes.
It was back then, of course, men reporting on women.
Yes.
And the fact that women did things differently.
And even now, of course, you've still got this gender pay gap problem.
Yes.
And there's all that sort of stuff. So you pioneered not only women in the Foreign Office, but also the thinking about the women and the imposter syndrome and high-level jobs.
I don't think I pioneered that. I think many women have.
I'm going to keep calling you a pioneer, whatever you, however much you want to contradict me. Now, you wrote this fantastic book, but you didn't, or did you? I keep a diary like politicians do so that they can do bestsellers at the end of this. But if you didn't keep that diary, how did you remember it all?
I kept a very occasional diary. But actually, what happened was that I've explained that my parents and I were often in different countries.
Yeah.
And I started writing letters home really when I was at Oxford, because they were in Beirut. And then later I got posted to Bangkok and Jakarta and other places. And I wrote these letters. And they were in some ways a sort of diary, but I was also trying to explain to my parents both why I was there, what I was doing, and what the life was like in a very different world they didn't know. And my mother kept those letters. And after my parents died, I found this immense mound of letters. And I got a granddaughter, actually, my granddaughter Elizabeth, to type them all up digitally. So, but then when I started reading through, I realized they were really considerable historical interest.
Yeah.
So that's really the basis of the book. And can I show you, because I'm so pleased by how it's been produced. But Hollywell Press, who did it in Oxford, they did this really clever thing of using some of the letters and passports and things like that as the sort of cover to my book.
And those are those old airmail letters that we used to use. Yes.
There's also, one or two old passports and things like that. It does really give one the feeling of these postcards and the letters from all over the world.
This is great. And we have a question in from Monique, which gets us to exactly what I wanted to talk about. How many countries did you visit in your role of ambassador, and which were the most interesting or challenging? Tell us some stories, Juliet.
Well, my role of ambassador, I was only in Luxembourg. And I probably would have had another, in fact, I know I would have had another job if I'd stayed. Yeah. But as a diplomat, goodness, that's quite a tall order, actually, because I actually served in Europe, let's say, in Belgium, France, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg.
Goodness.
And I also served in Bangkok and Jakarta and Laos, actually. When I was in Bangkok, I was also sent to Laos for a reason.
Goodness. Yes.
And when I was in Jakarta, I also paid a visit to Brunei in an official capacity.
Right, yes.
And one
Brunei is the little
things.
Sultan. Who we
so that's
just...
enough to go on
yes.
with.
No, that's Brunei's the sultanate, isn't it?
It's part of the island
in
Borneo.
Yes,
it's a sultanate.
And the sultanate Brunei owns the Dorchester Hotel.
Yeah, one of the richest places in the world.
Yeah, that's. But you were in Paris as a diplomat with the Queen, and in a chateau, but you were besieged in it. Tell us that.
Well, in Paris, I was by then sort of halfway up the tree. I was what was called press counsel. And when the Queen came on, she came on what was known as a private visit. She said she would like to see some French chateaus. And anyway, see some French chateaus she did, with me and sort of tagging along, and a lot of other people tagging along, they say. And we, having done us up, been to the Loire a little bit, we went down to Burgundy. And first to a chateau of Sully, which is very nice. And while we were at Sully, we heard rumors that French farmers, that people who were producing lamb and mutton, were very cross and were demonstrating. And why were they cross? Because Britain back then was fighting for New Zealand lamb to be allowed into the EU, EEC, as it was. But anyway, so we... this huge procession of cars went on, and we arrived at Etoisse, which is a charming little chateau. I've got a picture of it in the book, actually. I'll try and show it to you in a minute. But it's a little chateau with a moat all around and fortified, and only one way in. And anyway, in we went, and the Queen was having tea with the owners. And we suddenly were aware that there were fires starting, particularly in the front. The way in, but also the other parts around the chateau. And it became clear that the demonstrators were burning sheep, of all things. so everybody was rather excited about this. I think they were rather amused rather than alarmed.
And this was to, to tell the Queen about the monarch, the British monarch, about that disapproval of British policies?
Well, I think it was probably to tell the French press that the farmers were really rather cross.
Go on.
I was just going to say, actually, I think the préfet, the French local authorities, dealt with it very well and calmed things down. And we were only about half an hour late by the time we left. Yes. I was very amused. There was somebody with a placard saying, "Dundalk, revenez, sauvez vos moutons. Dundalk, come back and save your sheep."
And I know you can't tell us what the Queen said, but what was her reaction to the whole thing?
Well, she took it very calmly, I must say. I don't think she was easily flapped, the Queen.
Yes, fascinating. What a fascinating story. We have another. Geeta has sent some emojis of laughter at your story there. We have another question from Geeta. Were there situations you were frightened in? And if so, how did you get over it? And then which was your favorite country to live in and why? Let's have answers to both of those questions. Frightened?
I was very lucky that I never served in a really dangerous country. I mean, some of my friends had some really scary experiences. And I remember when I was in Bangkok, I had a friend who was in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Mm. And I went over to see him, and he showed me the point on the embassy stairs where the mob had been held at bay and that sort of stuff. That never happened to me. I served in much easier places. So I think the most scared I was probably getting into a little aircraft going up to Laos and realizing it was dripping and that they had cows and things up and down inside the plane.
Yes,
so, some of those things were a bit hairy.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't really frightened.
And your favorite country?
Oh, that's so difficult to answer that, I think.
Give it a go.
I think probably the one that really intrigued me most was Indonesia. We will probably come on to Indonesia, and I wasn't there at a time that suited me personally at all. But it is an absolutely fascinating country.
Well, let's
you know it, I'm sure.
I do. I've been there many, many times. But let's go to, because we've talked about Europe and the EEC negotiations, whatever. Let's go to Asia, because you were there at a very interesting time, weren't you? Was it the Vietnam War? It was all the Cold War stuff going on.
I was in Bangkok. Yes, Bangkok was, the Vietnam War was sort of potting up. And indeed, through much of the time I was there, I think it was 80% of the bombing of, do you remember the Ho Chi Minh trails?
Oh, yes, yes.
For those who don't, I should explain that they were the ways that the North Koreans got armaments down to the south by going through a mountainous route that led through Cambodia and Laos. And the Americans started bombing that, really quite seriously and rather horribly. But about 80% of the bombing was taking place from Thai airports in Thailand. But this was something that the Thai government did not admit to publicly. So politics in Thailand were extremely peculiar because, you know, the biggest elephant in the room would not be mentioned.
Yes, because bombing and the bombing of Cambodia was what the recently late Henry Kissinger was involved in that, and he.
I think that was later. I'm still talking the quite early 60s when I was there.
The early 60s.
But I was there. I was working in an organization called CETO, of which few people have heard these days.
Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, I think. That
well
was
done.
It was going to be like NATO for
it
Asia,
was,
wasn't
NATO
it?
There was NATO CENTO, which was in the Middle East, and CETO.
Yes.
But CENTO and CETO really died along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And CETO died because two of its original members decided that they didn't really know quite which side they were on. And I'm talking about Pakistan, which was also its war with India. It was really...
It's pretty dubious about the whole thing. It's
and
fascinating.
The French, who were sort of making up to the Chinese anyway, and the Russians, to go. We might talk about to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's all sort of fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating sort of period of history that tends to get forgotten because, of course, both those areas that we've been talking about, Europe and Asia, are now rising into the fore or have done in the past in a different thing. I just wonder what your it's a big question. You know, Europe now, Europe when you were taking part in those negotiations, how would you describe it as being the same and being different?
Europe. Well, of course, the EU is just so much bigger than the original six that we were trying to join. I mean, back then, when I'm talking about the Heath negotiation, the EU was still in its formative stage. And of course, if Britain hadn't made the mistake of getting out of the negotiations to set it up, it would have been a very, very different organisation to start. But we were trying desperately to get on to a moving train. And by the time we joined, Spain was still, it was no longer putting on parts as it went along, but it was still a moving train we were getting into. I think I'd say I was tremendously struck by and really affected by the idealism of the people I met in Brussels in the early 60s.
That's interesting, yes.
They, you know, people worked through the night. One just felt that one was working for a better Europe, above all for peace in our time. Yep. So the Second World War cast this very, very long shadow. Since then, I'm not sure the EU hasn't got too big to be a comfortable organization, because how do you bring 28 or now 27 countries along with all these different policies? So many compromises have to be made. It's become very bureaucratic. Yeah. Clearly, a lot of things have gone wrong. But I mean, I still consider personally that it was a marvelous thing for Europe that it was created. And I personally am extremely sad and rather worried, actually, in a way, that we are no longer members.
No, that's a very well put thing. Let's move to Asia, firstly, with a story, because you were besieged in a chateau with the Queen, and then you were hobnobbing with these Chinese generals in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. How did that come about?
Well, one stage in my career, I was sent off with the Royal College of Defence Study. I called the sort of main chapter in my book about that, I called it How to Be a Brigadier, because essentially what it is, it's a sort of senior staff college for serving officers who are moving away from the regimental phase to sort of very senior command. And there have always been a couple of diplomats. And anyway, I was sent there 1 year. And I have a good year? So I had a wonderful. And amongst the things we did was to spend a month touring different parts of the world. And my part of the world turned out to be Far East. We went to Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, and China. And I'm now talking 1981. And China was really, it was China under Deng Xiaoping. Yeah. And it was just beginning to reach out to the rest of the world.
This was after Mao Zedong and his dreadful Cultural Revolution, that all finished, then Deng Xiaoping came in and began the reforms of the China that we know today, yes.
And this was the early sort of stages of those reforms, and also of China beginning to reach out to the rest of the world. But anyway, the Red Army took over our tour. They invited us, and so the whole month we were in China, we were the guests of the Red Army. And we received very remarkable treat, including being received by the Deputy Chief of Staff in the Great Hall of the People.
And of course, some of these people would have been part of Mao's long march.
They were indeed.
And the civil war against the nationalists that are now in Taiwan.
They were indeed. One trouble is that we never knew who we were going to meet. And we didn't, of course, therefore know who they were.
Thanks.
But as one traveled around, and we did travel around Beijing, Shanghai, and various. We had these long train journeys.
Really?
And a very interesting guy was our sort of shepherd, if I can say that, a man called Dong Le Dong. Anyway, as one spent this quite some time, the ice began to crack and he was describing things. And I remember him saying then that you could tell the background of senior officers by their age, and that the older ones, and he particularly pointed out the chap we met in Great Hall of People, who had been on the Great March, the next lot would have arrived rather differently. And younger, he said, you wouldn't know where they came from anyway.
And of course, there were the wars. There was the Korean War, wasn't there? That many of them would have fought into, I suspect.
They must have.
Yes.
It was quite interesting because we were taken to the Chinese War College. I forget exactly what it was called, but that was the one place back then that was still clearly Maoist. Yeah. You're mentioning the Korean War. Particularly, do you remember there had been a Chinese-Vietnamese war?
Yes, yes.
And there were,
in 79 that was, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right. Yes. So, but wherever we went, there were these diagrams of these campaigns with aggressive arrows going in all sorts of directions. And actually, some of the most interesting ones were about the relationship with the Soviet Union.
Yes.
All the arrows were fiercely pointing at China, that's it. They were obviously regarding the Soviet Union as terrible. It was not like the rest of the world of what we saw in China. It was as if we were in a slight time machine now.
What a fascinating story. We have Lil says, what an interesting guest, Juliet, is. Did you learn any new languages?
Yes.
Which ones?
I'm actually rather a believer in learning languages. I started with good French, but I learned Thai to quite a good level when I was in Thailand. Well, pretty good. I mean, I could sort of, with pain, read the newspaper, but I could actually negotiate a meal and a room and whatever it was if I was traveling around the country. And I actually had to do the cookbook in Thai with my... I had one of the heroines of my book is called Buna. She was my Thai housekeeper. And she was such a nice woman. And basically, we talked Thai. We had to.
It's not an easy language, Thai, is it?
It's very difficult because it's tonal apart from anything else.
Yes.
I mean, ma is different from a, and different again from ma. Yeah. So you have to.
And
you have to start singing it always.
Give us, Gita says, I would love to hear how Indonesia was fascinating for you. My godfather was from there, but I've never been. Give us a very brief pen picture of Indonesia.
Indonesia is vast, and it's one of the most populous countries in the world. It's incredibly diverse, because you've got these islands. We used to say 13,000. Last time I looked it up, it says 16,000.
Good grief.
Some of them are big, lots of them are tiny, et cetera, et cetera. It owes its coherence, really, to the fact that the Dutch colonized it, and they governed it from Jakarta on the main island of Java. The independence started, really, when the Japanese left. Was occupied by Japan in the Second World War. And believe it or not, Britain took over briefly because the Dutch had been occupied, of course, in Europe. And we were asked to take the Japanese surrender and were in charge for a few months, a few rather disastrous months, because I don't think our government had any idea they would be dealing with an independence struggle as we were. When Indonesia became independent, they had a real problem of putting everything together. I mean, the struggle against the Dutch and the Japanese was, of course, a great unifying factor. But they also decided to promote the language, the Indonesian language, as a unifying factor. But having said that, almost all Indonesians have a different first language and have a tribal connection. So anyway, that's the sort of cultural background. But it is a wonderfully beautiful and diverse country. It's on the Ring of Fire, so it's got this terrific line of volcanoes running through it.
And it has the was now become the magical island of Bali, doesn't it? Which is a Hindu predominant island, and the rest of it is predominantly Muslim and wonderful.
That's true.
And Borneo is also, you know, the exotic name Borneo. That's Indonesia as well, isn't it?
That's actually why I mentioned going to Brunei before.
Yes.
Indonesia has a lot of that island. And when Brunei was about to become independent, it seemed to be terribly important that Indonesia should be benevolent. And relations between the two, while we were still on top, have really been almost non-existent. So anyway, I can't believe I made a huge difference, but I got the Foreign Office permission to go over to Brunei and really came back to tell Indonesians a bit about it. ASEAN, which I'm glad to say wasn't quite enough.
Yes. We have got to move now to Luxembourg and to Girton because we are running out of time. Appointed the ambassador to Luxembourg, which is a small country within the European Union and Europe. When you heard that you were going to become ambassador, tell us your thoughts.
Well, I was thrilled because, of course, I'd always been hoping I'd get there eventually, but I certainly wasn't expecting it. That got another little story. I'd been on a holiday and I got back to my desk and picked up the phone. In a personnel department here, we posted in you in your absence. You're going to be ambassador in Luxembourg. Oh, it has been through all the boards, but it hasn't yet been to number 10. Have you ever met Mrs. Thatcher? Me. Well, yes, I have actually, but I don't think you'll remember. Oh, that's all right, Ken. The reason this is funny is because Mrs. Thatcher had a reputation for more or less eating diplomats. She didn't approve of the Foreign Office or like diplomats very much. And if one had met her, she might very well have decided that you had done something really wrong. But she, fortunately, had no reason to against me, so I sailed through.
Yes, and also would she have supported a woman getting the role, wouldn't she? Because you were one of the first female ambassadors, or did it not work like that?
I don't, to be honest, think she thought like that particularly.
Yeah. And in Luxembourg, when you had that job, you were at the heart of Europe in a way, because...
Absolutely.
Yes. So give us an idea of what that was like, given what you told us about your earlier experiences in Brussels.
It was quite interesting. I went back to Luxembourg actually last month, not having been there for a while, and I do realise that the job of the British ambassador must be very different from my job, because when I was there, the whole framework of my job really was British joint membership of the European community. It was still community. Because we came up to negotiating Maastricht while I was there, actually. But almost all the business I was doing, a lot of it was about what Britain's interests were, the EU, trying to get the Luxembourgers alongside, trying to report back what their stance was on what was coming up in Brussels. That was very much the sort of focus of my work. I mean, there were lots of other things to do as well, but that, so different. And the other thing, one is back then a lot of the ministerial meetings used to take place in Luxembourg. Three times a year, Council of Ministers met there. So I was effectively running a sort of hotel because ministers used to come out and spend the night. Douglas Owen would say, can you get Jacques Delors around to dinner?
Very quickly, you went from there when you left the Foreign Office to another great job, historical job. We could have a whole show on that, but we've only got a couple of minutes. Mistress of Girton College, Cambridge. What does that job entail?
Well, it's very different from being an ambassador in several ways, really. Decision-making is extremely different in a college. Everybody has the right to their say. In the Foreign Office, and I think in most walks of life, if there's a disagreement, it simply goes up the line.
Yes.
But think more Greek city-state, if you're thinking of a college. What you've got to do is sort of work to get everybody on side and get opinions going as well as you can. Arriving in Cambridge, I didn't know much about how the university worked. And so I sort of used my Foreign Office techniques of going to call on. But basically, I should explain that Cambridge and Oxford are federal universities. And therefore, I found thinking EU,
yes,
what's done at the centre and what is the independence of the different constituent parts was a useful way of thinking of it.
Yes. But in a way, the way you describe it is that you have to be even more of a diplomat as the mistress of Girton College than you do as a diplomat in the Foreign Office.
You have to do, in some ways, you do. You have to, different forms of leadership, very different.
Yes, yes.
I should also say that most of the time I was there, I was on the University Council as well. So it was fascinating learning how Cambridge worked.
Yes. I should say that your book is showing sold out on Amazon, but it is not actually sold out. You can get it from the Girton College website, and I think the proceeds from the book go to Girton College.
Yes, they do.
And Belgravia Books, or go to your local bookshop, or keep checking with Amazon, because it is a fantastic read. Juliet, stay there for a moment, because I have to tell people what's coming up once I get the sun out of my eyes and my list in front of me. January 25th, Lucinda is with Jennifer Roberts, The Beauty of Her Age. That's a tale of sex, scandal, and money in Victorian England. And 26th, Lucinda is hosting Book of the Month, which is Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Have you read Pride and Prejudice, Juliet?
One of my favourite books.
There we are. You should join the book club. We'll send you a secret link to it so that you can
please
join
do.
That show. Yeah, absolutely. January 30th, Lucinda is with Emma Darwin, talking about famous ancestors. Lucinda is from Charles Dickens, and Emma is from Charles Darwin. And Emma's memoir, believe it or not, is called This Is Not a Book About Charles Darwin. That's going to be a fantastic one. February 1st, Lucinda is with Fran Hill, and her first novel, Cuckoo in the Nest, which was inspired by Fran's own experience of being fostered and featured on BBC Women's Hour. And February the 8th, Lucinda and I are at Riverstone Fulham for a live in-person Goals to Conversation, where we chit-chat. Email concierge@goalster.co.uk to come along, or just turn up, come and throw tomatoes at us, have a coffee or a cocktail, pull us apart, and enjoy that chat. Sex, scandal, and money. Is that what you remember of the Foreign Office in Victorian Britain?
Not quite, I think. I don't know. I mean, obviously, in a world of attractive young people, there would have been sort of relationships, I'm sure.
Yes.
And scandals, I'm sure we've had those too, actually, though I'm not rushing into my mind, I'd rather that's to say.
We've got
money.
Some...
Yes, of course one had to worry about money, because particularly as an ambassador, you're ultimately liable to be called in front of the House of Commons.
To
defend your budget your use of your budget.
We've got some wonderful, fascinating chats, says Anne. What have we got coming in? Humphrey and Juliet and Joe, for a fascinating interview. Thanks for being such a pioneer. All the best to you all. That's Geeta. And Monique, I really enjoyed this discussion. It was absolutely brilliant. You have led such an interesting life, Juliet. Thank you for telling us all about it. Jean Joyce, what an interesting guest, great interview. And a question, was Indonesia a Hindu country and part of Greater India? Bali is the only Hindu island now. I think it was the other way around, wasn't it? Tell us.
No, she's basically right. It was a Hindu country earlier on. I always forget the earlier history, but there was an empire called the Majapahit, for instance. And if you go to Yogyakarta and Solo in central Java, there's still a lot of the ruins, some of them are Hindu. What happened was that the sectaries, the Muslim traders, came round the outside of the island and sort of proselytized, and it increasingly became Hindu.
Oh, okay.
There's some fascinating books about that if people... But if you're in Indonesia, as close as you are to the coast, the more likely it is to be Muslim. Go inland to these volcanoes, and you get to a sort of mixture of Hindu and even sort of earlier spirit stuff.
Oh, that is a fascinating answer to a really interesting, rather unique question. I have a final question for you, Juliet. You have to answer it in 10 seconds. In the rough and tumble of life that we all have, when life seems to be getting too much, mountains unclimbable, that sort of thing, do you have a mantra? Do you have something you tell yourself to keep going and punching through?
Don't exactly have a mantra, but I think one must think there's been worse in the past and there will be better in the future.
Love it. Worse in the past, better in the future. That's it. Time's winged chariot is attacking us and we have to retreat back into real life after the plethora of fantastic and fascinating stories. And also, motivating. What a Goldster conversation this is. Have you taken us right inside the workings of Britain's Foreign Office and explaining the imposter syndrome and how you punch through all that. Until next time with Lucinda, a Sex and Scandal, and Jennifer Roberts, stay warm, stay safe, stay curious, keep reading, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you so much, Juliet Campbell, for captivating us on the edge of our seats and with your stories. It's a really, really great conversation. Juliet, bye.
Bye, thank you.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.